Welcome to the Creative Gap Podcast. Glad to have you here, and today we have another great episode. But before we dive into the conversation, I want to give a quick thank you to our sponsor, MusicBed. Creativity comes to me when I get a sense of inspiration, and lately that is due to MusicBed. I'm sure you have heard me talk about them before, so take this as a sign to switch to MusicBed. Here's why I switched over. The music is made by real working musicians and artists. It's not just stock music that is made with no emotion or skill. These songs are the product of true musicianship. With over 50,000 songs, selecting the right song is so easy with MusicBed's platform. I don't have to spend a ton of time digging to find the right song, but I find 3 to 4 options that work every single time. I'm more inspired as a creative using MusicBed, and I want that for you. For a limited time, MusicBed is offering a free 14-day trial so you can see the difference for yourself. Switch to MusicBed today with the link in the show notes. Let's welcome to the show, cinematographer Bjorn Charpentier.
So how was your shoot in Belgium?
It was my first time in Belgium, first time shooting in Europe. It was an amazing experience. I really, really had a good time. The film was great, and just like being involved in the director's family. She's from Middelburg in Belgium. I don't know if you're familiar with where that. So she's from there. So I got to kind of like be involved in her family for like 2 weeks. I met her grandma. I got home cooked meals.
Nice.
So I got a really a full experience, and everybody's so nice there. It was really great.
So what did you shoot? Was it a short film or commercial?
It was a short film. Yeah, it was 5 days. We started prepping it probably like 5 months ago or so. It was awesome.
So who was your camera crew? Are you a light crew? Because Patrick Hagerman was your gaffer.
I had Patrick. Yeah. Patrick as gaffer. I had Steven Van Den Broek.
Steven Van Den Broek.
I don't know if you
I see his face. Okay, yeah, I said, I see what it is. Yeah.
I worked with him and then another gentleman as like a swing or grip. And then camera team, I brought my first AC from Los Angeles over.
Okay. You're based in LA.
And say, I'm based in New Jersey, but I work in LA a lot, and I like working with this first AC in particular.
Okay, nice. Yeah. Nice.
And then the second AC was from France. I forget where she's from, but it was good. It was amazing.
Okay, good. So I assume the weather wasn't too great.
The first day I got there, I landed. It was beautiful. Within like an hour, it got cloudy. An hour later, it was like crazy amount of wind, and then it started hailing.
Yeah.
So I got every season within. I got every season in like 3 hours there.
Were you properly dressed for the weather or not?
I probably could have brought a thicker jacket. But overall, it was decent. Yeah. But it seemed like everyone there was used to it. I was like, oh, it's raining. They're like, yeah, I know. We're used to this.
Yeah.
It'll be gone in like an hour, maybe 2 hours.
I know. The problem is that right now it has been a miserable, miserable spring so far. It usually doesn't rain that much. I think we had like 2 days of sunshine for the moment. So
wow.
I'm shooting a beer commercial next week. And the only demand from agency and client needs to be sunny. So, they open their wallet again.
Is it outdoors? Or
A couple
exteriors
shots
are in.
Yeah, we have like sunset people gathering the hops and putting the trucks. Mm-hmm. Oh, what else? Because it's for the Olympic Games, so we have also athletes running and it's being sunset. So we time it out, and then today we said, just. Let's bring some 18K, some Dinos.
Right.
Just to be safe.
Just in case. Right. that's awesome. So that's that's for the Olympics coming up?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's exciting. It must be a big commercial.
Fairly
big.
For Belgium, it is kind of quite big, yeah.
Mm. Do you shoot a lot in Belgium still or not really?
No. I do maybe 2 or 3 jobs in Belgium a year.
Oh, wow.
And otherwise, all overseas. I do one feature or TV show a year, and then the rest is all commercials, but also those are all mainly international. It's the couple of directors in Belgium I like to work with, and those are one of those. And that's why I'm staying here. But otherwise, I'm traveling.
And your home base is in Belgium, though? Like, your family is in Belgium? That's where you live?
Yeah. Mm.
Do you think, like, the balance of one feature, one show, and all commercials is, like, a pretty healthy balance? Because I'm always curious, as, like, someone that has, like, a family, even, like, kids, because part of the reason I started this podcast is because I'm getting married in 20 days.
Oh, congrats.
Eventually, thank you. Eventually, I would like to have kids
in Belgium.
Of my own. Huh?
Not in Belgium.
No.
You want some? Eventually, I get it.
yeah, for sure. Eventually, I want to have kids of my own. And part of the reason I started this is just like talking to people that have, you know, families that are at like a high level in this career and how they do it, really. I'm always curious as to how people manage the relationships of family in this industry.
I think, honestly, that's the most complicated thing. Yeah. That's really the most complicated thing. Yeah. So, my first feature was in 2016 when I was shooting Beirut with John Hamm. Yeah. It was directed by Brett Anderson. And the moment, because I have an agent from 2013. And in the beginning, I was like, you know what? I'm looking mainly for bigger commercials, better commercials. My goal is always to go for features. But at that point, I was like, let's first start with bigger commercials. And it doesn't mean bigger budgets, but better scripts mainly. I'm always chasing the scripts anyway. And I told them features, yes, but not right away. And then a couple of years after, they sent me a script and said, look, if you're interested, take a look, read it, see what it says. And then I talked to my wife about it. And in her mind, she was like, do your feature film. You're going to miss us all and you'll never want to do it again. And I completely fell in love with shooting features. It turned out completely different.
Opposite.
Yeah. But no, yes, it is the most complicated thing for me is to find that balance. I love what I'm doing and I want to do more features, but I know it's not possible really family-wise. So that's why I'm very selective on the feature films or TV shows I'm doing. Because I know that's going to be the one for this year. So I don't like the idea of shooting a feature film just for the sake of shooting a feature film. It takes so much time and effort away from your family that it needs to be worth doing that in a way.
Right. And, you know, when you're not working or you're done with a feature, how often are you taking breaks? Like, what do those breaks look like for you? Are you done with a feature or a show and you kind of just like start right back into commercials?
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of friends of mine, when they're done with a feature, they want to take a break for a month and not shoot. And if I'm home a week and the main first 3-4 days is fun doing nothing, you know?
Yeah. But after, and then you start thinking, you start going
4 or 5 days, like I need to do something. So I start working around the house or... I like to, I built my own remote head, for example.
Oh, that's cool.
My own gear heads. So I built those during COVID. I just like to be busy with things. I started to weld. I've never done that before, but my wife wanted to have some flower. How do you call that? Like a doorway? You know what
like
I mean, right?
I believe so. Like an arch?
Yeah, exactly, an arch. So, but it needs to be like 20 feet long. So.
Oh, wow. A big one.
So we start doing that. We like to be busy. But what I do, because when you've gone for a feature, and usually for me it's between 10, 12 weeks, you're so long away in commercial land that they kind of forget, like, oh, he's still doing something. So what I usually do is like 3 weeks before I wrap, I start emailing people like, I'll be back in 3 weeks. So by the time I'm home, there's like 10 days in between and I can shoot my new job already.
Smart.
But I mean, yeah, I just finished a feature film in January. I started in September. I shot with Corinne Hardy. the director I work with on Gangs of London, and we shot a new horror movie called Whistle. And when we came back, I went, I think a week after I was in Paris, the week after I was in Amsterdam, and then the week after this, I was in Hong Kong. And then my wife's like, I need to take a break. Now it's too much.
I was gonna say, because right now I'm learning how to communicate of like jobs with my fiance, because if it were up to me, all the jobs that I'd be traveling every week, and like I'd be going all over the place if I had, you know, if it were just me. But how do you manage the relationship with your wife, or how do you communicate with your wife if you really want to take something, but like she really wants you home? I don't mean to get too personal, but this is like stuff that I'm very eager to learn.
No, man. It's a very good question. And what we do is every feature film, it's a conversation with my wife. Do it or don't do it. Because she used to be a physiotherapist and she quit that for several reasons. But one of them was it was not doable with my timetable and her timetable and the kids. So she decided to stay home. And because of that, every job I do is a conversation with my wife to say, do we do it or not? Is it necessary? And sometimes it would be like, look, I mean, do we need financially? No, then we don't do it. Do we need it? Yes. Or sometimes like this is the right script with the right director, with the right producer. And it's maybe the wrong time, but it would be a smart move to do it. So all of those conversations comes into play. That being said, like I said before, she's not a fan of me traveling, but at the same time, it's also,
it's part of the job.
It's part of life in a way, but it's also, it makes me very happy being creative on something like this. I love watching movies. Every day I see a movie or a TV episode. And you're watching, but at the same time you're studying, and I can talk about it 24/7. I mean, I love the whole visual aspect. And as a kid, I always want to make movies. I never want to make small movies or Belgian movies. I always had this bigger American dream, and now I'm doing those. I'm chasing my dream, and I'm living my dream in a way. So she understands that as well, and she doesn't want to put that in between. But it does. I mean, yes, of course there are awkward conversations and painful conversations over Zoom. and that's why, I'm always saying I'm doing one a year. Be very selective on it.
Well, I appreciate you sharing that. I kind of want to go back a little bit. When I was in Belgium shooting, I was talking to Patrick, the gaffer, that we know mutually. And he was saying that he remembers you kind of crewing for like, was it 10 plus years, he said? Like, what was your journey to become a DP? Did you kind of climb the ladder traditionally?
Yes. If I go back a little bit further in time.
Sure, absolutely.
I don't have any relatives or friends in the business. I always, like I said, I love watching movies. I didn't know it was even a job option. And when I was, I think, 14, 15 years old, somebody mentioned to me that there's something like film school. And from then on, I decided that's what I want to do. But I mean, I didn't know anything. So for me, what do we know? A director. Which one do I know? Steven Spielberg, Michael Bay.
Absolutely.
That's it, basically. Yeah. And actors, I mean, I'm from Belgium. I'm a black belt Shotokan karate like Jean-Claude Van Damme. So as a kid, you want to be the next Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Right.
but when I went to film school, like every single day, I was like oh, that's how you do this. Oh, that's, and I was the annoying student. Like, how do you do this? How do you do that? To the classmates, were like, shut up. I mean, the bell already buzzed. We can go. Stop. And I just want to know everything.
You had passion. You had passion immediately.
Yeah, I still do. 20 plus years, I still do. I still feel like I'm 22, which my body will say the opposite. but no, I'm passionate about all of it. And like I said, I always dreamt of those bigger movies, and a lot of people in film school, like, no, you need to do the small art movies, and that's popcorn Hollywood, it's not art, and I didn't really care about it, but I was like the ugly duck in school in a way, because no one was like, me, you can dream it, and nobody will ever make it that far. So I'm very, very happy it turned out nice, but I fought for it. It wasn't given to me. I didn't know anything. So I start as a trainee camera assistant, then as a second AC. I did that for 5 years. I mean, to be honest, the second year in film school, in the beginning, I wanted to be a director. Again, the only job option I know in the industry. Right. But then afterwards, you understand, okay, there are more functions. And I think I was in my second year that I knew, like, okay, I want to be a cinematographer.
What about cinematography led you to kind of want to pursue that over directing?
I think I'm more busy with the visuals. I work with so many talented directors, and the way they can peel off layers with actors just to get them in a certain state of emotion. I can't do that. I don't have any ambition to become a director. I always want to be a DP, and I love the idea of collaborate with a director and see how we can visually support the story and try to find new ways, creative ways of doing that. But I don't have any ambition to direct, to be honest. So yeah. As a focus puller, I did that for a year. Really hate it.
It's completely I didn't like it either.
It's a completely different job. It's a completely different job. But as a second AC, and at that time it was all 35 mil, you're aware of which lens on the camera, which film stock, what camera filter is used, the stop. You can see the frames on the playbacks, and during the takes, I had time to look at the light setups, what each light is doing. So it was a way, great way for me to learn everything from camera side and all set, look at lights and grips. But once you work as a focus puller, there's just no time. You're just so busy with that part. I did that for a year. Yeah, I mean, I wasn't good at it, to be honest. But I think 2007, 2008, I was like, I'm going to make a transition. I did all at once. I got married, bought a house, and changed career. and then I think in 2008,
that is quite a year.
And, yeah, it was 2007. In 2008, I bought the Red camera, and then we had a recession. I was like, oh, all my money is into a camera. Boy. Now we have recession.
Amazing timing. Perfect timing.
Yeah. And at the same time, it was perfect because having my own camera package it allowed me to make a deal with production, and I got so many jobs. And I start shooting. In the beginning was music videos, short films with friends, and then funny enough, I was shooting a student's final project, and then when the movie was done, I realized that the director's mom owned the biggest production company in Belgium commercial. So I start shooting small commercials there. And I think in a way, as a cinematographer in the beginning, you have a lot to learn. Everything goes a little bit slower, but you'll hear me say passion a lot, but I was very passionate about what I'm doing. And passion is a very positive virus that goes along the whole crew. And I think that helped me a lot by, even if you give me the most mundane commercial and sell a jar of pasta sauce, I would make this the best pasta sauce visually I could do at that point. And I treat each job like its own little gem. And you go the extra mile and you push every department together. And I think if you're very enthusiastic, your crew gets enthusiastic and it can only flower from there. So I think that really helped me a lot in the beginning, just to pursue that passion in a way. you find the same directors. And I want, honestly, I don't care too much about cars, but I always want to shoot car commercials because you have the Russian. Early in your career in Belgium, we don't have a car market really. I mean, it's not the right country for car commercials. So you don't really have the opportunity to do car Russian arms. I mean, we don't have it. It needs to come from France. So the first thing they say is that, do you have it on your reel? No, but you can't do it. Food commercials, your Phantom. I want to do that as well. Because I didn't want to go specific in one direction. I want to do everything a bit. So and just taste a little bit of beauty, car, food, vignette, slice of life, that kind of stuff. So I watched different styles. And same thing with food commercials. They want to see my Phantom reel. It's like, yeah, I don't have it, but the same thing. It doesn't change. It's still a surface that's reflective. And mainly in the food commercial, it's a lot about the food stylist in a way. And there was a pizza commercial. It's like, I don't have pizza, but I shot risotto, which risotto is even worse because it's like one new color. It looks great. So, I mean, if I can do this, I should be able to do pizza, right?
You could do pizza.
Exactly. But then I wasn't allowed to. So I went to the same director and then I put money on the table. He put money on the table and we made our own Phantom commercial. Obviously, it was never aired, but we had something on the reel that was Phantom. And from then on, I was able to do Phantom jobs. So I invest a lot in myself, time-wise, money-wise. I think it's crucial to invest in yourself. And whenever I have time available, I was doing lens tests, camera tests, playing around with gear, trying to understand it better. I went to a fashion store and I asked them to give me a mannequin doll because they had a certain mannequin doll with a face with eyes and eyelashes and a darker skin. I was like, perfect. So I put that there, went to my gaffer's place and then used different light just to study that light at that distance with that diffusion. What does it do? Took a picture and then wrote next to it. So I do a big library in a way of light setups. I love doing camera tests. I still do. Every time I'm going to a rental house, I see a lens I haven't tested. I test at different stops, different light conditions, flares. Like, it goes in my database. And the moment I go in a country where I'm limited in options of gear and they have gear I haven't used before, I can see my diagram. Oh, that's going to give this look, that look. And it helps me a lot. It's fun.
Yeah. It seems like your passion for it has never died. It seems like from what I'm getting, it seems like it continually gets stronger, your passion for cinematography as you navigate these like bigger and better, you know, quote unquote, better jobs. Is your role as a cinematographer now in what you're doing, what you envisioned it would be when you started?
Well, I'm not there yet. I'm not there yet. No, I mean, it's funny because every time I do a job, I always think, I don't know how I can make the next one better because you're always going to be judged by your previous work. Somehow it always gets better in my point of view. So I'm very happy on the progress. But again, it's because you keep studying stuff.
Yeah.
Funny enough, I was thinking to do the same thing that you're doing right now with me. And I have several DP friends as well. And I wanted to ask them, it's like, and in a way, yes, I'm a geek. I love all the techniques and the graphics and all of that. But at the same time, I think lately I'm more interested in the philosophy of why do you choose this? And it's not really why some gear, but mainly it's like, what was your arc in a way, or your train of thoughts to visually support the story? What was the process in this? What did you decide? And I think that's for me one of the most creative and fun parts of prep on a feature film is trying to understand, like, how can I help story wise and how can I support visually the story? Because I'm not a fan of visuals for the sake of visuals, because then just commercial almost. It's beauty, but with no content.
There's no depth.
No depth, exactly. And I like the idea that there is an idea behind the photography. Mm. What I usually do is I take a, in my prep, I make a kind of a rule book. And I don't know, for example, hold on. I don't know if you've seen the movie Fractured. It's on Netflix. Don't worry, if you haven't, no worries. I won't judge you.
I've seen it pop up. I haven't watched it yet.
But it's, in short, it's a story about a father. He's a family man, and his daughter has an accident on the road. He goes to the hospital. Mm-hmm. She needs to go for a CAT scan. He falls asleep in the waiting room, and when he wakes up, the daughter isn't there. And he thinks the hospital is doing some illegal organ
transplants
and all of that. And as an audience, you don't know what's real and what's in his mind. And we played with that visually as well. On my other movie, Blood, also directed by Brad Anderson, about a boy who got bitten by a dog, and the boy starts to change.
If I could interrupt real quick, I remember reading an article about that movie, and you said initially that you weren't a fan of horror, but this film resonated with you not as horror, but as like a story about a child because you are a father.
It's, you know, exactly. It's a love story for me. It's a love story. It's a love story.
What I wanted to bring up there is like, you're not necessarily thinking about the genre, but what is deeper than in the genre that you can resonate with?
Yeah. No, exactly. Because for me, it's a love story of a mom doing everything humanly possible to save her kid. And that's something that, as a parent, you recognize. And that's something that spoke to me a lot. And by doing a horror movie, I was like, yeah, I need to look at horror movies just to understand
I think I saw some. You watched Insidious for like 5 minutes or 10 minutes. Yeah, I think I read that somewhere.
It was a Conjuring.
Conjuring.
Then I was 5 minutes in with the Annabelle doll in the beginning. I was like, no, I can't handle this. No, to be honest, I've been watching now a lot of horror movies because I just shot a new horror movie, and a lot of friend directors of mine are horror lovers. So I was in LA with Matt Beeler. He's a commercial director I work a lot with. And every time I go, I can stay at his place. And I was there during the month of October. And I was doing a Walt Disney commercial. I think I was there for 11 days. It was like, you know what? October month is Halloween month. It's only horror movies. Right. So I saw 9 horror movies in the 11 days. And then now with Corinne Hardy doing Whistle, we lifted together. We shot that in Toronto, and we lived in the same house for the whole shooting time. We lived together. And then in the weekends or whenever we had time, we went in the basement. There was a big TV, and we played a lot of horror movies. And I really enjoy them now. But I think there's a horror
it's
movie.
It's funny how that works. Yeah, I love that.
But there's a horror movie like, I don't know, like a Dracula movie or a monster movie. It's horror, but that's fine. I think for me, it's more creepy when it's all about spirits, like paranormal activity. That freaks me out.
Yeah, for sure.
It's funny because right now I'm watching Wednesday with my daughter.
And
she's behind her pillow, and I find it so amusing. I told her when my movie's coming out, Whistle, I need to go with her. I don't think I'm going to watch the movie. I'm going to watch her because it's so funny to watch her watch the movie because she's so emotionally involved. And last time she saw something, and you see, I mean, as a movie maker, you see the cut coming miles away, but she was the
first.
She didn't know. And the creature, whatever, jumped screen, and she gave herself a whiplash.
Does she know what, like, is she old enough to understand what you do? And has she watched all of your films?
Yeah, my kids are almost 16, 14, and 7.
Oh, okay.
So obviously my youngest isn't too much aware. My other daughters are aware. So yeah, it's, but they haven't seen a lot of stuff I'm doing because it's mostly thrillers and horror movies. So they're not watching this.
Right.
I don't think they haven't seen any of my feature work. They only saw my commercial work.
Mm. Mm. I want to go back a little bit to something that I'm trying to figure out as I shot my first feature and I'm getting some scripts sent to me for some new features. And I think the hardest part for me is trying to read a script and figure out how to approach that like first meeting with a director. And it's a director you've never worked with before. Like, is it, I know every DP has their own style, the way of, you know, approaching that first meeting. But for me, do I go in with, you know, my own ideas? Do I just allow that director to speak their mind and, you know, be more of a listener? Like, what is your approach to kind of like that first meeting?
I think my agent told me, it's like, when you do an interview with the director, when the director wants to interview you, it's also a way for you to interview him.
Mm.
Because he's not only working with you, you'd be able to work with him as well. And if he has a complete different mindset that you don't see happening, and then you have an out there as well. You're going to spend so much time together. It needs to be a strong collaboration, I would say.
Right.
I think I can explain from my experience, but there is no right or wrong. I think it's their own way. But when I read the scripts, visually a lot of ideas coming to my mind. So it could be stills, could be, and then what I do is I make a mood board the way I see the movie.
Mm.
And then when I talk to the director, I want to see what he's thinking. Obviously, I want to know what his vision is. But at the same time, I also want to share my ideas. Because sometimes, I mean, if they're complete opposite, it's a different story, obviously. But
definitely.
Sometimes is you have an idea, but I'm a strong believer of there's a good idea, there's a better idea, but you end up with the best idea. So if I only do what the director is telling me, then it's only going to go to that level.
Mm.
And I like to bring my ideas on board. And if they're not the right, I mean, at the same time, it's also the first encounter, obviously. So everything goes. But for me, it's also a nice stepping stone because sometimes you have directors that don't know how they want to translate visually. So they lean more towards the DP. So I like to present them with ideas. Like, that's an option. That's not, I like this, I like that. And then they can say, look, I love this, I don't like that. And so I already know which kind of way
they
go with it. But it's also for a director, I think, nice to see, oh, right, I haven't thought about that, but actually that's clever, better, worst idea. And that idea can lead to something else. So I like that bounce board. And the directors I work with so far are always very open for the collaboration. And when my agent sent me the script of Beirut, I read it and I didn't know who the director was because they just sent me the script. And I made like, I don't know, I think I had like 80 pictures selected as a visual mood board. And then I emailed him and said, look, I read your script, love the script. I don't know what you want to do with it, but when I read it, those were images that came to my mind. This could be a stepping stone for something else. This could be the right way, could be the wrong way. This is just a idea. Let's see what happens. And he loved the visual mood board already. So that was already a nice starting point for that job. Now, coming from commercial was a big conversation with production, with director. Like, you used to do a 3, 4, 5 day job. How do you feel about a 34-day schedule? For me, it's more like the movie will be shot and done before day one. I will be prepped, and I'm not necessarily prepped in a way that everything's going to be storyboarded, but I will know exactly what needs to be done and the way the director wants to work. Like, some shots were at that point was storyboarded because they were like bigger scenes, complex scenes. Or stunts. So those were storyboarded. But otherwise, like, you know what, for that movie, it's like, I don't want to do too many storyboards because I want to see how the actors wants to move in the room. And I want the camera to be almost more like a documentary, like go back and forth.
Right. So it seems like you like to find like spontaneity on set.
Yeah.
And like the freedom to find that moment instead of being locked into that specific.
That's correct. That's correct. Yeah.
Or that specific shot.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's also the way I lit this the movie in a way. It's like I want to make it as free, camera free as possible. Mm-hmm. That means that I want to use a lot of. I work very, very closely with production designers. Like if we paint the room, let's use a satin finish or a glossy finish, not matte, because I don't want to use too many cinema lights. I want to use a lot of practical lights. And by having the walls shiny, they will reflect more. And then I gave references from Darius Kunji's work on Seven.
Mm. Beautiful.
Also, the makeup. I asked makeup to make everything more shiny in a way, because we talk about Beirut. It's sunny. It's warm. He's an alcoholic, so I want skins to be shiny, and all of that helped me a lot at low light sequences. And I like to play with a lot of color temperatures, different color temperatures. But by having everything very reflective and a lot of practicals inside the room, it gave me and my second operator a lot of camera flexibility in a way. For the energy that the director was after, like, let's make it spontaneous. And you want to have some out of focus moments. So I didn't want everything to be perfect. And I had an amazing focus pour. So once we did we didn't do too many rehearsals, but once we did it, the moment we rolled, I just stepped one step forward right before I said action, just to put the focus pour off. So I have this focus shift. Yeah. It never worked. It was always spot on. It was amazing. It was always spot on. I couldn't sabotage it.
Yeah, not once. Oh, that's amazing. So I find that so amazing, because I haven't learned like that type of communication or that type of relationship with the makeup or productions. I have conversations with them on the things that I'm doing, but I never thought about the wallpaper, you know, being, you know, a shiny, or the paint being shinier because it would be more reflective. I guess when you were coming up as a DP and you were, you know, camera trainee, second AC, a little bit of first AC, what elements of your journey helped you kind of navigate and become a confident DP that, you know, asks for these things? Like, did you have mentors? Were you just very observant?
I think, I work a lot with directors called Norman Bates, the Belgian directors, which I'm going to shoot next week with again. And in the beginning, and they made I'm going to step on some toes, but the problem is, as a director, when you start your career, you're always going to be stuck on small budgets. And then you need a crew. And then they notice that the big part of a very small production, it goes to crews. And then light department and grip department, they usually are very, we don't have a union, but they have their own kind of union. They very strongly stick together, which is great for them. And they want so many hours, and then the next 2 hours is so many percent, after that so many percent. Mm-hmm. And because it's physically demanding work, and they need to leave early. They will come home late. They have less sleep. So it needs to be compensated 100%. But in the end, my director's like, in the end, they make more money than me as a director. It's like, and they say, we're the directors. We have all the time in prep. We have the shoot. We have the post-production. We have all the responsibility of the shoot. And then, if it's a one-day job, the crew comes in, and then light and grip takes so much budget that, and I mean, a gaffer and I don't say this in any disrespect to those departments, so please don't take this the wrong way. But they were like, not as a gaffer, but as a spark, they come in with less responsibility as a director, but go home with a bigger paycheck than director. And they were like, that's not fair, which I completely understand. So the first 2 years, they said, look, we're going to shoot commercials together, no light, no grip. Done. They won't be on set. We'll shoot available light, we take an AC, and we shoot at the right time of day. And that has been a very good tutor for me, is to study the light more, find the right locations. And when you go, for example, because we were able to shoot globally, but even if we were doing a big campaign, we shot in Bangkok. Same philosophy, no lights, no grips, or we just take like a, we call it PFL, polyfloppy light tunnel. Yeah. Just we bounce, we block with small light band, and that's it. And just keep it mobile, shoot the right time of day. And then you look at locations. And in Thailand, all of those buildings, interiors, exteriors, there's so much texture. And they'll come back with a lot of reflective material on the table, on the wood, on the walls, all of that. And that helped me a lot by realizing, okay, this is doing that, that's doing that. So let's put a varnish on the table so it's more reflective. A boring table, let's just put a glass plate on the table. So because then we have the reflections of the windows, and then on the longer lens you have the bokeh. So all of that we learned by saying no lights, no grips. And obviously they came back when we had the bigger jobs and we need, or even smaller jobs but need to be lit. But we learned a lot by just saying no. And if you look, for example, I'm not saying Lubezki is doing the same, but if you look at Lubezki's work, it's a lot of available light with just big negative blocking. And every year I go to film schools and I dissect my movies, and DPs always think, I need to put lights. No, you don't need to put lights. You need to shoot at the right time of day, and you can block the light, use a poly. You don't need to use more than that, really. You can be very, very creative with almost nothing. And as a student, if you don't have money, and the little money you have is a fortune for that production, don't spend it on lenses. Spend it on the right location. Because if you have the right location...
I so agree with that.
You don't need to use that much light. You don't need... I did a music video once, and the whole music video was in a black box, where the main talent, we block the light from the side. So the moment he goes back, it was in complete darkness, and he goes forward, he goes into the light. And he was in a rocking chair, so he goes in, out of light, and then different characters. And we were in a white studio, and everything had to be black. I said, guys, it took a lot of time on the grip department just to make a black box out of it. It's like, it's not a smart move. Yes, it's a cheap studio, but we lose production time. At that point, I was also too junior in a way, just talk to production. You can't do this because you lose time, you lose money, you pay more on gear. Spend $300 more on the right studio, and it will be faster and cheaper. And a lot of productions right now, they have younger producers to younger executives, and they don't always have the experience, and then they make decisions like they don't want to spend too much money in prep, because then it's like I want to keep it. It's like no, spend more in prep, it will be cheaper at the end. But if you don't spend this money in prep, you're gonna have so many problems during the shoot or in post, and it will end up more expensive. And it's a very difficult lesson to understand that you need to spend more money in the beginning to be cheaper at the end. That's where experience comes in, I would say.
I love that. I've run into so many similar scenarios where, you know, you get a mood board, you get a treatment for a commercial or something, and, you know, the images are like wood panel backgrounds, green walls. And then you get to the location, you see a picture of the location, and it's just like white walls everywhere. Yeah. It's, but I think that's like, you know, I think I'm slowly kind of getting out of the phase of just like, you know, people not considering production design and art as a important aspect to the piece and filmmaking.
Yeah.
And a lot of what I work on now, it is a prominent piece, and I always push for it. Like anytime I'm working on a project, one of the first things I ask for is like, who is the production designer? Who's in the art department? Because that is like the key to making our job look good.
Exactly. It makes our life so much easier.
Yeah.
But it's like, if I come to a location where it's all white walls, first question is like, can we paint it? And if you can't paint it, can we put a flat in front of it? Or just break it up? And if it's not working, I go say, look, I mean, I would gently propose not to use that location. And sometimes you can't because they're too far down the road or it's an agency demand. It's like that. But then what you request is, like you said, wooden back wall panels and all of that. It's a white wall. It will look different. And it's always a fight. Unfortunately, at that point, yeah. And that's why for me, it's key to work with amazing production designers. And if you work with amazing production designers, they know our jobs. When I was shooting Gangs of London, Matt Gant was a production designer from the UK. And I just came because I did the final two episodes of the second season. So, and they've done season one, season two. So they were very senior. But then I talked to them what I needed. And then in the end, every decision they made was always with me in their, or as a DP in their backgrounds. Like, we're going to put a window there. We're going to see that we can put a LED strip over there. So if they understand that if you want to shoot this way, we need to do this. And then I'll still ask, like, can we have a practical on stand here? I would like to, and I speak a lot with the prop master. Like, I want to have a lampshade that looks like this. I need a light that is not an LED, but it needs to be an old neon light. I need to have that kind of lampshade just going up, or if it's soft, but all of those will help me translate the way I want to tell a story. And I speak with a production designer, with a producer, and with sorry, with director, and with the prop master to find those right lampshade. I told them, look, if we do so, if we do a job, if I need 5, bring me 10, because then I can see which one works better. Because sometimes it's too bulky, or it's too small, or it's too red, or whatever. And just by having, I always ask, give me a lot of options. Because the way I work is, I don't really like the scene. I like the room. And I like the room with scene, with the intention of the scene in a way. But I will never light it just for one angle. I like the room that it works almost 360. So when the actors come on set, I try to keep my light as much outside through the windows. And then inside, I like to use all the practicals. And then on the floor, is like one or two lights and diffusion. That's it. So as an actor or talent, it's way more
freedom. They have
the
freedom.
Because you can feel the room. If you have an actor, it's completely covered in diffusion and blacks and whatever. And then there's a boom. It's like, yes, it's their job, but you block it. It becomes very, very artificial for them. And by opening up the scene, it gives me a lot of freedom also for two cameras, and you can move faster through the rooms. And it's a different style of photography, obviously.
Yeah.
But for what I'm doing, it works really well. It helps everyone. And actors like it, because when you change the angle to the opposite side of the room, I don't need half an hour. I mean, I just move two, three things, ready to go. And actors don't need to go to back to the trailer. In 5 minutes, I'm ready to go. So they can stay in character. There's a good ambient on set. I think it benefits everybody within the room. The producers are happy because we keep moving. The crew, there's a nice flow to it. The talents can keep within character. It's a win-win.
Amazing. I want to move to the gentleman, if you don't mind. Because when I first saw it, I binged it immediately. I think I watched the entire season in like 2 nights. I believe, yeah. I am big fan of that show. Just walk me through this kind of process. How did you get involved? This is your first project with Guy Ritchie, is it?
Well, I did work with Guy Ritchie. It's a Guy Ritchie series. Guy Ritchie directed episode 1 and 2, and then other directors stepped in. And I did episode 3 and 4 with Nima Nourizadeh. And I haven't worked with Nima before, but when I was doing Gangs of London, he was doing the block before me. He did episode 5 and 6, and I did 7 and 8. So we came across each other. When the show came out, we saw each other's work. So that's how I know Nima. And the producer was the same producer from Gangs of London as well. So the producer knew me, the directors, we haven't worked together, but he knew me. He talked to Corin, the director as well. So he knew what kind of person I was to work with. Why am I saying this? Because a lot of people have a lot of egos on set as head of departments. And I always say, like, ego, for me, egos are it's always in the way. Leave it at home. It won't help. Again, I'm a big believer of good idea, better idea, the best idea. But ego will always block that in a way. So I keep... Right. I deviate a little bit, but why am I saying this? Because the way I work is I like to include my crew. Like, I do all my prep work, but once on set, if a crew member has a better idea, please speak up, because the best idea wins. If it can comes from a trainee, from my gaffer, from a spark, I don't care. Mm-hmm. If it's better, I go to the director, I give that person credit, say, like, that person thinks, proposed to do this, I think it's a better idea. What do you think? And by doing so, people get more validation of their work. They're more in part of the creative process. And they get challenged. They get the opportunity to get challenged and propose things. So I feel like it helps everybody moving forward to a better script or to a better project. I'm not a big fan of like, no. You know what? I'm a DP. Let me do those goals. It's like, right. I don't like that ego attitude, which a lot of people are doing that. And me, again, there's no right or wrong, but it's not the way I like to work with people. And for this show, when I came in, I think the complicated situation on a lot of TV shows right now in the UK is that a lot of projects got greenlit by a streamer platform, whatever, early on. And there's only like one episode 1 and 2, and all the rest is not even written. So they are already in production for 1 and 2. And meanwhile, you have the writers, showrunners writing the other episodes. So you're always behind on everything. And that was on The Gentleman also. I think that's the biggest challenge would be that, is that... things kept changing all the time. We built hallways and we built our own lights. And then the next day, when everything is built and ready to shoot, next day they say, okay, you know, we crossbar this, we crossbar that. And then all of that money is lost in a way. And I mean, that's the way it works, but it makes it more expensive at the end, I would say. But I mean, it ended up in a great show, so it did work. But it makes it harder in prep, because you don't know where it's going and everything keeps changing. We were shooting a scene, episode 4, after the explosion I'm not sure I'm going to spoil too much, but when it goes to the private collection part, yeah. So and then there's you have the big fight, and then in the end, he steps out, and the guy has a knife sticking out of his chest. So we shot that first. We shot the post action part first. So we had to decide like how they're going to look makeup wise, where we're going to put the dagger, all of that. And we shot that. Went to sleep. Next morning, new script pages. No knife, gunshot. We're going to reshoot now. It's like, no, it's fine. We're gonna Photoshop it away, and then. 2 days later, script change again, really? knife again. I was like, that becomes a challenge. And like the two last weeks, the call sheet, every day the call sheet, and you look at it, it's like, we won't make that call sheet. It's too much. We had too much to shoot on the day anyway. So those were the biggest challenges for us on the show, I would say. And in the end, you make it work. Obviously, you make it work, but just. If you do a feature film, everything is set, and obviously there's some script changes, but they're minimal in a way. But here it's like, yes, I don't mind taking the bunny out of the hat and do a magic trick, but there it was requested every day at least twice. So guys, I'm not sure how many rabbits I had.
Oh my god, that's funny. Oh my god. So is that like normal? TV shows now? Is things change so quickly?
Yes, yes.
Like daily?
Well, on that show, yes, previous show as well, and friends of mine experience the same thing. So it's same more thing. And more, yeah. I'm not saying it's everything every time. Like, those are the challenges right now. And yes, it becomes more expensive because you keep changing stuff at the end.
When you got this show and you got involved in it, there, I guess what I'm curious about is, like, the show itself has like an element of class, like elegance because of the stature of these people and how they live. And I'm curious as to when you read the script, you understood that the storyline, how involved were you in the initial look of it? Like, how was the collaboration process and trying to make it look like of that class and elegant? And where was that pre-production with you and like the showrunners? How involved were you in the initial look creation?
Well, there's several answers to that. Just to be clear, I did not set up the look of the show. That's the work of Ed Wild. Ed Wild, the cinematographer who did episode 1 and 2 together with Guy Ritchie. So they decide the look of the show, the way it's going to be shot, which camera, which lenses, the way they want to light the actors. So they, in a way, they decide that look. I think a lot of credit has to go to Lulu, the costume designer, because she did, I mean, for me, the star of the show is Lulu. She did an amazing job on all the costumes, and it helps you so much. And then obviously the locations looks insane. And once you have those two already, I mean, it becomes way easier to do your job as a cinematographer. Mm. But I had a conversation with Ed. We went for drinks because I want to know, like, okay, if I'm going to continue your look, I need to know what were your creative decisions and why, so we can support that line. So they were like some do's and don'ts of the look of the show. You maintain that. Mm. But then in the end, you still have 90% of different locations. So you have some creative freedom in that as a cinematographer.
I always wondered, like, because I hear other interviews of DPs coming in mid-show having to kind of work within the looks that the original DP created. I always wondered, like, do you feel creatively fulfilled still, or is there like a limiting feeling?
Oh, no, it's a good thing you say that, because that was my first, when I was doing Gangs of London, I was doing the season's finale. I was like, I mean, how much creativity do I have? And then there was a conversation with my wife as well. It's like, yeah, but I mean, you can't even decide the look of the lenses in a way. You want to shoot anamorphic or spherical, you want to shoot hard or soft, contrast. And it all really plays a big part in the final look of the movie. But in a way, you still have so much creative freedom. At the same time, I don't want to reinvent the wheel. The great thing about the production that we had is like the director and the DP changes, but all the rest stays the same. So the same gather, same focus pool. So you can also rely on them. It's like, is this in the same style? Does this stick out too much? And then, for example, on the previous block, they, as a moon box, they created a massive three light construction with 20 vortex. And there was a moon box. So when my gaffer told me, yeah, in the past we used a moon box with 20 vortexes on a frame, I was like, I haven't done that before, but if it works, it works. Okay. Let's do that. Let's play with that. Let's see what it does. Because I've seen a rough cut of 1 and 2. It looks amazing. So if that works, well, we use that. I don't want to reinvent stuff. I can put my time and effort in other things. And we spend a lot of time, because every day, we try to do as much as we can in prep, but at the same time, there is so much to do, so many changes that you can't really storyboard everything. And Nima, director, want to have a shot list of every single scene before we go to the shoot. So once we finish our day, we drove together, we went to a pub, and we put the iPads and the pen and paper on the table, and we start shortlisting everything again for the next day. And within that, for, I don't know, 30 or 40 days, away the amount of time we shot, every single day we went to We had to eat anyway, so we went to a pub, and then we were working, and like we went over the day, like that worked well, that worked, that didn't work. We had problems with this. How can we solve that? We need to talk to those departments, and you want to smooth out everything as much as you can. I feel like as a cinematographer, you are also delegating a lot of departments, and mm-hmm. a lot of people come with problems that are not really your problems, but it's your crew, so you're going to help them solve things. And with other departments as well, like again, this went wrong there, but try and understand that perspective of that person. You need to, it needs to be as smooth sailing as humanly possible. Right. So you're doing that a lot. At the same time, you're trying to see, because we want to shoot everything with two cameras. And mm-hmm. then the director want to shoot, he want to cross shoot everything. Ideally, in the past, I was always operating A camera and operator for B camera. And then usually I do side by side, like an over shoulder and a close up, like 90 degrees. Mm-hmm. But for this one, because we did a lot of static shots, and we wanted to shoot simultaneously and cross. The complexity is like this is trickier to light. Then it becomes even trickier on the wide angle lens, because on longer lenses, sure. can shoot more. But there we want to go like, we shot full frame and we were at 40 mil was a long lens. And usually we're on 25. So it becomes very challenging. And at some point we had conversation with two people and then we shot like this. And then the operator's batteries were slamming up. We complained to him. It's like, it's not possible. I mean, we need to find a solution. It's not easy to work that way. Also, the gentleman was, for me, the very first time I stepped away as an operator. I asked if I could operate, but they were like, but there are two operators already on the payroll. Mm-hmm. So, you can operate, but then he's going to be benched. I was like, you know what? I'll take this as an exercise.
First time ever?
Yeah.
On any project?
Yeah.
Wow. Besides Steadicam, I'm assuming, and stuff like that.
Okay, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
And I love operating.
Did you enjoy it at the end?
Yes, but I mean, I made it very clear to them, like on my new project, Whistle was the same thing. I was like, you know what? The director wants me to operate. I was like, no, let me have two operators because then I can stand next to you. And as much as I love to operate, sometimes it's easier because then you have the boat monitors and you can look and see. Because otherwise, when you're operating and you say, okay, I am on an over shoulder or close or whatever, and your B camera is doing the other angle. You can't always supervise that. And then when you look at it, sometimes it's just too late. It's like, I wish it was a bit more like this, or I wish he told me, because then I could change a light there. And so I start to work with on my camera, my onboard monitor, but then next to it, I had a transmitter with his monitor on it or on a stand with B camera on it. But then it becomes very stressful in a way. And I do like the chaos, but sometimes it's a lot of chaos. And I was like, you know what? Let's avoid this time and let's step back and have two operators. But I always spoke to the operators, look, I'm in Belgium, we don't use operators. As a cinematographer, you train to operate yourself. So for me, it goes really hand in hand. I told them, look, yes, you're going to operate, but there are moments I need to have the camera in my hands. And I don't want to go for permission. Sometimes just I need to do this and just allow me. And okay, no worries. Yeah. Whenever you want, just take the camera. And they were very friendly with it. They had no problem with it, no egos about it. Because sometimes if you do handheld, you want to go on instinct and you want to feel, you want to feel the scene, like it needs to be zip and there, just pushing there. And we always use the intercom system, but I told them as well, like, look, if I tell you to do a close up, don't just hold a close up. If as an operator, if you feel you want to push in, if you feel you want to rotate, do it. Because 99% the instinct is right. Because if you wait for me to tell you, by the time I tell you, push in.
It's too late.
You need to register, be ready and move in. Even if it's a split second, it will still jar because it becomes a mechanical move. But if you do it on instinct, it becomes natural. It's like just follow your instinct. So in a way, the great lesson I learned is the perspective of time is different. Because as a director, it's like, can't you move faster? I'm waiting. It's like, no, no, no. if you're on the dolly, you're doing all of this, you're busy the whole time. But now you need to stand next to the director and say, okay, let's move the dollies. And they say, guys, I mean, counting those response on this, I mean, does it really? So the perspective of time, I mean, it's completely different. It's like, okay, now I understand what the director is going through. I never imagined that before. And shooting those mansions, I mean, as lovely as they are, it's tricky because the carpet is that old. It's a monument, the carpet, basically. So you can't push dolly on top of the carpet. You need to put your own carpet on their carpet, push dolly on that carpet, and it's, you need to move the dolly like 3 feet to the right. You need to bring another carpet, put it to the left, push it. And so it's so time-consuming. So yeah, that was a challenge. But having stepped aside and having two operators, you can really perfect your frames. Like, it's a perfect match for the shot, reverse shot, in the over shoulders, in the close-up, because you see both angles, and then you can say, you know what, gently padded left, zoom in a little bit there, but then you can mold it in a way. And that's something I really enjoy doing that. Yeah. And also at the same time is, I set up the first frame, like I need a camera here, the other camera needs to be there, and then you take it over, make it better, and gives me time to spend more time with light, with grip. And if that's doing, I'm going to the first AD, like, okay, you know what, we can gain time on this, if we change this and that. I can go to the director, say, maybe that's not the, it's maybe an ID. I know we planned it like this, but now that everything is lit and set and the actors are playing, it might be better for those two shots to combine it. So it gave me other conversations while other people are taking care of the cameras. And I really enjoy that. Yeah. But there are moments that you want to have the camera in your hands, obviously.
Of course. Yeah, of course. About 4 months ago, I broke my leg and I was in a wheelchair and I had a big cast and I had to get surgery. So I was immobile for a couple months. And while I was working, you know, fortunately, I work with a lot of production companies that were really generous and still gave me work, even though I was, you know, not able to move. And this was my first time where I didn't operate a camera on any commercial, anything for a short film for like 3.5-4 months. And I used to love operating, like I still love it. And I thought I would never, you know, let go of the camera, but it made me realize how much more focused I am on the image and the picture and not like, oh, I got to make sure my shoulder's okay for this. I got to make sure, you know, I'm composing this correctly. I just focus 100% on the image, and it changed my perspective on my role as a DP when I'm not operating. I actually fell in love with not operating, to be honest with you.
No, I hear you. And it makes complete sense. I do like operating because I like the intimacy you have with talents. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I have operators. I mean, it happened to me once on the commercial where I need to have a second camera. And the guy was always on his phone. At some point, it was a big brand commercial with big directors as well. And the guy was on his phone and then, okay, camera, and I look at it, phone away, camera, cut, camera away, okay, phone again. And so I went to him and said, just put the phone away because you're just saying to, I won't say the brand, but say, you're literally saying, fuck off, I don't care, I'm here for the paycheck. That's not the right attitude. I need you to be present, listen. And if nothing happens, then you just wait. But don't be doing this in front of an actor where a producer can see you, where a director can see you. You just tell them you don't care about what you're doing. It's not the right attitude. And why I like to operate is, there was a TV show I was doing in Belgium. And there was a scene where an actor had to be very emotional, but he's like a tough guy. He doesn't show emotion. So there was like, you know what? You're crying inside, but you're not showing it. But I need to feel it. And it's an amazing actor. And I'm behind the camera. And he's giving me performance and gives you goosebumps. And they're just further away because of reflections of that. And they say, cut, put the camera away. And before even the director can come over, I went and said, look, that was amazing. That was amazing. I mean, you really touched me. Whatever the note of the director is, I mean, that was quite something. And you gain a trust with actors. I'm there to make them feel, I mean, you don't bullshit about this. You need to be sincere, obviously. But
absolutely.
I was talking to on a show with Michelle Monaghan, we were doing Blood. I was halfway through production. I was like, you know what? Because two cameras and sometimes goes a lot and things change and you can't do overtime. We're doing middle of COVID as well. I told Michelle, like, sometimes I wonder if it'd be better for me just to step aside, have two operators. It's just, no. I want you behind the camera. Because the moment they say cut, I'll be able to look at you and see how you feel about it. And that's something that you enjoy having a relationship with an actor. The way I will always make sure there is a safe environment to work with. It's a silent environment to be around the camera. And whatever I need to hide something like pimple or whatever, I'll cover you. Don't worry. I will make you look great. Or, I mean, whatever needs to be done, maybe it needs to be ugly for the emotional scene, but you're there to protect them because there's so much stuff going on. They need to be safe. And if they feel comfortable with you around them, they will open up even more. Their personal space becomes bigger and you can enter more and even get better emotions. And that's why I like to operate, is actually just to have these close collaborations with actors and the trust that you, and sometimes you can just do small things. It's like, just change that. Give that reaction a bit earlier or later. It helps me for this and this reason. And these small things and makes everything better. And that's what I love about it. It's also, you're the first viewer. I mean, because I love the viewfinder. There's nothing else than what you see in this blackness around and just your face. And if you're behind a monitor, you see the monitor, but you see the dolly, you see the light, you see the boom, you see the guy talking, and you get sometimes you feel more like
there's a disconnect.
Exactly. And the director can say, I have it. I go back, say, you know what? Let me do one more. And I'm going to do a small change on my end, or I'll say I have to do something. Because you feel, like you said, a disconnect. And when all of this comes together, it's just good. You turn around, the director has a big smile. You know you have that connection.
Yeah.
But you only know it because you're the first viewer. You feel the scene, but it's like, yeah, I know. Okay, I had to push earlier, or I had to rotate there, or just stand still. Maybe I should have done that. And I like all of this. I do a light design plan and sets, whatever. But once I'm on set, I try to forget about it. And then try to see what we have now. What can we do better? If we can't, then we stick to the plan. But I always try to keep an open mind just to see if we can, with everything that we had already in place, can we even make it better? What if we do this? What if we do that? Why? And I feel sometimes an operator is easier. If it was very complicated, it's easy to say, you know, just you take care of that, then I can do something different. Yes, it depends a bit on the situation, I assume.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that perspective because I do agree the intimacy of operating is unlike anything like on set. It's such a unique experience being that so close to an actor. We're running a little bit over time in terms of just like my normal time doing this. Hopefully, are you still okay?
Yeah, no worries. No worries. Yeah, I'm
okay.
Having a blast.
I hope so. I think I asked this earlier, but like, what about cinematography now still makes you want to pursue it at the highest level? What do you still love about the craft, even as much as it's changing and changing quickly? And, you know, there's, you know, a lot of negative talk about the future of filmmaking, but what for you do you love still about cinematography to pursue it at this highest level and to continue to push harder and do bigger and better work and tell better stories?
I had the most amazing experience from all the jobs I've done. The best experience I had was on my last feature film. And it's all thanks to the director, Corin Hardy, because he's a guy who is very, very passionate. And I'm very passionate. And together you give, again, this virus to a set, and it wants everybody to make better. So everybody is trying to, we have a great idea, let's even make it greater, whatever. And keep analyzing things. I like to analyze script and say, what I do is when I read the script, I always ask myself, how can I tell this with a camera? So I imagine that's my character. I put a sphere around him. Where on that sphere needs the camera to be for that particular motion? And then when it's on that angle, what is my lens going to be to bring an emotion to the best? And then how can I light that emotion? And I'm always playing with those elements. And I feel like every time I'm reading new scripts, like how can I conceptualize the script, but how can I visualize this emotion better? And it's a ongoing search to make, and sometimes the easiest solution, the best solution. It doesn't always need to be very creative. Sometimes a fixed shot is a perfect shot for what it needs to be. But it's a search for what's the best solution to tell that story. I think that's the part that always keeps me looking for new ideas. You watch a show and say, God, that was a great idea. I like that idea. I need to remember that or write it down, because I can bring it to the table. And I don't want to copy something from somebody else. I want somebody else to inspire me, and then I want to use the idea and make it my own. But you're always looking for the right idea to tell a story. I think that's something that keeps me on my toes to make it better in a way, and to keep exploring how to visualize it better in the most complex or most simplest way sometimes. But that's always the exercise, how to tell the story emotionally. I think that's the key search for me. Yeah. I don't know if that's answered your question.
Yeah, no, that's a great answer. I have one last question that I normally ask, and it's you where you are now at this point, and you're sitting across the table from that younger version of you that's in film school, that is eager, passionate, that is annoying all the other students, and that version of you is sitting across from you now. What advice would you give that younger version of you?
I think I'm quite calm right now. I think I'm very excited. And people sometimes miss the excitement with you stressed. I think my advice would be just
calm down.
Not calm down, but project calmness. I think towards a producer and director, I always say, no worries, I can do that. And if I don't know how to do that, they don't need to know that. That's why I have my crew, and I lean a lot on my crew. I have an amazing crew, and I spent a lot of time interviewing people to find the right crew. And each of them, I tell them, I'm going to be away from home. I'm going to miss my family. I want to build a new family. I don't need a crew. I need family around me, because we're going to see the best and the worst from each other. If you owe this crew member money, if you are sleeping with this person's partner, I don't want to put you together on set. If you have a big ego, it's all about you. I don't want to be dealing with you. We're going to have enough on our plate with this movie, this project. I want all the noses to be pointing in the same direction. And I want, we went for drinks during the weekends. We went to spas. You get to know each other. You can get invited by crew members' families. And I love this. It's a family. The film sets a family in a way. You take care of each other. And that's what I like about this industry in a way. And I want to have the right people around me, because you inspire them and they inspire you to bring the best to the table, to support each other, to give each other the better opportunities. Like, for me, it's like, I don't care if I take this shot or that shot. Which one do you prefer? I need both anyway. Mm. You prefer this one? Go for it. I'll take the other one. Unless I need for a particular reason. But otherwise, like, no. I mean, just be collaborative, friendly, supportive to your crew. I've been working with dictators as well, and I don't want to do it again. It's like, it's a nightmare. And there is already so much stress on us that I don't need on a crew that would be under my department in a way. I'm thinking about your advice. It's a good question. I never skipped any class at school. I was very grateful. My parents were always very supportive because my father's a civil engineer. So it's all about techniques, nothing about arts in a way. And they were very supportive on it. I wished I maybe paid more attention to art class, study paintings. Mm. Now it's like, oh, fuck, I should have done better there. Now it's like, sometimes teachers give you an assignment and you just do it. But it's like, no, I mean, a lot of kids that are doing their final projects and they're doing their final short film, for a lot of them, it would be the last time they're in full control of it.
Mm.
And I would say, like, enjoy it. Chase your dream, go for it. But if this is your last film, you never know. But I always think of this is going to be my last feature film because I don't know what's going to happen next year. I want to make the best possible movie I can with the best possible crew around me. But enjoy the ride. I mean, they're long hours. It can be brutal in the snow. But it's an amazing industry. It's an amazing job. I am able to travel the world every year around the globe, basically. And you see so many cultures, so many people. Enjoy the ride. Lose the ego. Enjoy the ride. Yeah, make great movies. Don't make movies for making movie, but make something where you can put your heart and soul into it. It's like, yeah, that's mine, you know? I think, yeah, it's nothing better than that.
Amazing. Yeah. Man, thank you. Thank you so much for taking the time today. Like, I learned so much today. I felt like I couldn't keep a smile off my face listening. Just like hearing the passion. Like, it really is so amazing hearing someone speak that is so passionate about what they do. I truly feel so lucky that I got to speak with you and, you know, I get to do this. And I appreciate and I hope that people take away some valuable lessons.
Well, thank you.
No,
I think a lot of people say I'm blessed and sometimes a bit overrated, but I would say, yes, I am, because I was able, thanks to my parents, to be able to pursue my dreams. And then to be able to shoot the project I always wanted to shoot. But yeah, don't get me wrong. I fought for it. I sacrificed a lot for it because, yes, I missed my daughter or my son's first steps or first words. And yes, it comes definitely with a price. Don't think it comes for free. So they need to sacrifice a lot. I need to sacrifice a lot. You just need to make for yourself aware if it's worth it or not, I would say. It's, yeah, I mean, I don't want to end on negative notes. I don't want to do that, but it's
okay. Leave people crying at the end.
No. No, it's, I lost my train of thought there, but it's, yeah, like, I lost a lot of things.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate
my
realness.
Wife's birthdays. I think
the honesty.
I missed more birthdays than I was present of my wife, for example. You don't always want to do that, but in a way, that's my life's path where it goes. And for me, I always wanted to do those kind of movies. So you never know how long you can ride a wave. And right now, I've been riding the wave that I always wanted. But you never know where it's going to end. So yeah, enjoy that wave.
Thank you, Bjorn. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming on today. I really appreciate it.
I had a good time. Thank you so much for your time.
Of course. Thank you everyone for listening. Hopefully you enjoyed it. Have a great day. Peace out. So thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Creative Gap Podcast. Hopefully you enjoyed today's episode. And if you did, there are a ton of other episodes for you to listen to as well. Check us out on Spotify, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, wherever you want to get your podcast, you can find it. Also, be sure to check us out on Instagram at Creative Gap for future updates, upcoming guests, and a lot of short clips. And if you want to support the podcast in a deeper way, feel free to join our Patreon community. And for those of you who already joined the Patreon community, thank you. And for those of you who are new to the show, welcome. Hopefully you enjoy it. And for those of you who have been here for a long time, thank you. So that's all we got for you today. Hopefully you enjoyed the episode. We'll see you next time. Peace out.